You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 25th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. It's 20:00 in Hong Kong, 13:00 in Warsaw, midday here in London and 8 a.m. in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Briefing starts now. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Coming up on today's programme...
The images are just horrible and just hard to watch, and our thoughts obviously are going to be with the victims of this terrible, terrible shooting attack.
Russia mourns the killing of 137 concertgoers, but why didn't Putin listen to the US's warning ahead of the Islamic State attack? Also ahead, Senegal's elections passed peacefully on Sunday with the opposition leader emerging as the favourite to win following 3 years of turbulence. Plus...
They kept saying to us over and over again, tell the West that we are tired but not exhausted.
We'll get the latest on the battle within the Republican Party to fund Ukraine and...
I'm a great believer in the Chinese idea that you've got to be as eloquent where you don't make a mark as where you do make a mark.
Maggie Hambling opens a new exhibit in Hong Kong, and we'll have the latest business news from Dubai too. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Vincent McAvinney. To Russia first, where the four alleged perpetrators of Friday's concert hall attack have appeared in a Moscow district court. Amid widespread reports, they have already been subjected to torture by the security services. Afghan-based Islamic State affiliate ISIS Khorasan has claimed responsibility for the attack, releasing body cam footage as proof, whilst the Kremlin continues to try to pin the blame on Ukraine, something which President Zelensky reacted furiously to on Saturday night, branding President Putin scum. Meanwhile, during a heavy bombardment of Lviv in the early hours of Sunday, a Russian missile reportedly crossed into Polish, and therefore NATO, airspace, raising concerns of a mistake leading to a direct conflict once again. I'm joined now by Jenny Mathers, a senior lecturer in international politics at Aberystwyth University, with a research focus on Russian politics and security. And joining us on the line from Tallinn is Matej Mazzini, a Polish journalist, writer-at-large at Gazeta Wyborcza, and lecturer in journalism at Collegium Civitas in Warsaw. Thank you both for joining. Jenny, if I can ask you first, what have these first appearances in court been like?
Well, it's pretty clear from the appearance of the four defendants that they have been pretty brutally beaten up. And we've seen, you know, really gruesome social media footage of actual torture on at least two of them. One had to be brought to the courtroom in a wheelchair and was reportedly taken directly from intensive care. So, you know, the security services in Russia do not have a reputation for treating people that they apprehend with great courtesy and graciousness. And clearly this is also the case here. They've been pretty rough with them.
And footage seems to have emerged of one of them being electrocuted. Why have they allowed this to get out?
Well, I think this is an indication of how tough the security services intend to be against terrorism. This is a bit of, you know, grandstanding. This is a bit of playing to the peanut gallery to say, look, you know, we're going to treat these people as they deserve to be treated. They don't deserve any consideration for us. They're not really human beings after all. So we will treat them in this brutal way. And we expect to be applauded for it. Basically, they expect to be recognized as doing their job and being tough and strong and supportive of Russia.
Just a week ago, Vladimir Putin won a fifth election. He seemed to have a firm grip on events in Russia. But this incident has revealed that there are some internal weaknesses in the structure that he has built. What does it reveal about his current predicament?
Well, I think It's embarrassing, clearly, for Putin because he's been in power in one form or another since the end of 1999. And he's devoted a lot of Russia's resources into the security services. He's given them very high profile, high prestige positions in successive sort of governments. And yet, you know, this hugely devastating attack, which has cost so many Russians their lives, about which they were warned in advance, and nevertheless, you know, didn't prevent it, and aren't seen as having responded terribly quickly to it. So yes, it's hugely embarrassing, and it should raise questions in many people's minds in Russia about how secure they really are, and how much faith they should put in Russia's security services.
And thinking back to past unexpected events like the Beslan school siege and the Kursk disaster, sometimes Vladimir Putin seems to disappear at times like these, where things have got out of his control. He's not quite sure to respond. Is that something we're seeing again here? And is it a dangerous time for him at all?
Yes, it is something that we've seen here. And it is definitely a pattern with him. When something unexpected happens at home, some sort of a crisis that he needs to respond to swiftly, he tends to disappear. And, you know, doesn't emerge for hours or days, depending on what's happening. So, yeah, it's a matter of concern that the leader of a country which is at war, where security is such a high profile issue, so important, you know, that he really struggles to deal with these kinds of unexpected events.
Matej, I just want to bring you in here. Part of the story over the weekend in the potential response from Russia was a really heavy bombardment across Ukraine in the early hours of Sunday morning. Now, Ukraine engaged its air defences to repel missiles and drones. But we understand that one of the missiles that was heading towards the Lviv region in the northwest of Ukraine crossed into Polish and therefore NATO airspace for just under a minute. And that prompted a big reaction in Poland, didn't it?
To a certain extent, because the overall mood here in Warsaw seems to be that the Polish authorities, both the civilian political ones and the armed forces, have actually everything under control. So the incident really indeed took place in the early hours of Sunday, when the missile aimed most likely at a target in western Ukraine entered the Polish airspace for a total of 39 seconds, which is indeed very little at an altitude of 400 meters. There were witnesses, there were direct reports of sighting, but the spokesperson for the Polish Armed Forces said that the Polish and NATO troops spotted the missile very quickly and were, since the very, very beginning of the intrusion, convinced that it wasn't aimed at any target within Polish, ergo NATO, territory. And hence the decision has been taken not to shoot it down due to a possible risk to civilian population. Because, of course, once you intercept and shut down a missile, there are debris, there are remains that fall and are likely to fall on civilian households as well. So two quotations, I think, stand out in this context. First, the Speaker of the Parliament, Szymon Hołownia, who said, we do not begin to act when missiles approach the Polish airspace. We do begin to act when they're loaded onto Russian aircraft back in the territory of Russia, which seems to indicate that the Polish side is very ready for this kind of incident. And then the armed forces spokesperson who said there was no need to act and we should not be responding with haste to any sort of Russian provocations and incidents because it was indeed a third such case of intrusion pretty much in the same area of the country, which clearly indicates a pattern that Russian missiles are routinely aimed at targets in western Ukraine, and they do take into consideration the risk of entering NATO airspace, but nonetheless go ahead with it.
Matej, you're currently on a reporting trip to Estonia, which has been an incredibly vocal member of NATO over the past 2 years in its criticism of Russia, but also its self-criticism of the NATO alliance. I understand you've been speaking to the defence minister this morning. What's he said?
So, just a couple of hours ago, I did conclude an interview with Hanno Pevkur, who is the defense minister of Estonia, and he's been very frank in his comments about the readiness of the alliance to counter the threat of Russian invasion. And when I asked him quite directly, to what extent do you consider a possible Russian invasion into a NATO territory a real possibility in your everyday decision making. He didn't even blink. He actually said that is something that we take into consideration, that we calculate almost every single day, and we're ready. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when, because Russia is not going to change its pattern of behavior. And here in the Baltics in general, not just in Estonia, the mood is much more combative, is much more resilient, because I think more than anywhere else on the eastern flank of the alliance, here the threat is actually quite quite visible, quite taken seriously. And I think that was echoed also in the comments of the defense minister, who said, we are running courses to high school students to increase our capacity of civilian defense. It cannot be just the military. It cannot be just the politics. We all have to be ready, because sooner or later, this is going to happen. And as long as Putin remains in power in Russia, that's a threat that we need to be ready to counter at any point in time.
And the presidents of Estonia and Latvia have gone as far as to call for conscription to come back across NATO members.
It seems to be something that most of the NATO leaders in one form or another do comment on, but I don't think there is much of an agreement in terms of what to do, because here in the Baltics, conscription is something that's widely spoken about in public. Contrary, for instance, to Poland, where it really isn't a topic of public debate in any way, shape or form. And in fact, looking at the most recent poll numbers, as many as 44% of Poles are categorically opposed to the idea of returning to mass conscription, which could be a headache for the Polish military, because whilst it is investing heavily in equipment, it's buying off-the-shelf military equipment from Korea and the United States as well, it might actually fall short pretty soon of people to operate it. The Polish authorities are aiming at the target of 300,000 strong professional military by the end of this decade. Right now, it's 180,000, more or less. So in order to meet that target, it will have to be recruiting at a pace of several thousand new members annually. And it's nowhere near that level. So whilst it might be very modern equipment-wise, it might not have enough personnel to combat a potential threat of Russia.
Jenny, if I can just briefly bring you back in here at the end. I think many people were surprised when it was ISIS who claimed responsibility for Friday's attack, given how depleted they have become in recent years. But France today raising its security level to the highest. Is this a threat that is once again endangering people in the West?
Well, I think ISIS has many branches, and I think it's wise to look into, you know, what each branch is aiming for and its capabilities. I mean, in the case of ISIS-K, as it's called, that attack that's claimed responsibility for the attack in Moscow, they may not be, you know, the largest branch, but they certainly have a very strong views about Russia. They have targeted Russia many times in the past, and they also have done obviously a very good job of recruiting people from Central Asia, from Tajikistan in this case, to carry out operations. So, you know, I think it may not indicate an overall rise of ISIS, but it certainly indicates that it's not a threat that we can regard as something that's no longer viable.
Matej Shmatzini and Jenny Mathers, thank you very much for joining us. Now here's Monica Lillis with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Vincent. The UN's Palestinian Refugee Agency said Israel will no longer approve aid deliveries to northern Gaza. According to the UNRWA, the decision was relayed in a meeting with Israeli officials, with no explanation given. The head of the agency called the move outrageous as famine looms. Ireland's governing Fine Gael party has named Simon Harris as its new leader, paving the way for him to succeed former Prime Minister Leo Varadkar as the youngest Taoiseach in Irish history at age 37. The Philippines summoned Beijing's envoy earlier today after accusing the Chinese Coast Guard of wounding three of its soldiers during a water cannon attack in the disputed South China Sea. China claims its Coast Guard took necessary measures against Philippine vessels that were intruding in its waters. European Sleeper, a Dutch-Belgian night train operator, will inaugurate its first ride to Prague today. The new 15.5-hour train service links Brussels to Prague and will pass through several European cities, including stops in Antwerp and Berlin. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Vincent.
Thank you, Monica. To Senegal now, where yesterday presidential elections passed off peacefully following 3 years of turbulence and opposition protests against the incumbent Macky Sall. Opposition leader Bassirou Diomaye has emerged as favourite to win after several rivals conceded. Joining me here in the studio is Alexis Akwa-Jiram, managing editor at Semaphore Africa. Alexis, thank you for joining us. Firstly, how did the elections go on the ground around the country yesterday?
The elections passed off relatively peacefully. I mean, there was no trouble. People seemed happy to just peacefully and calmly cast their ballots. So it actually went very well. It's very smooth.
And what's the latest on the count?
So the latest is that after a number of provisional votes came in, it looks like Faye is the one who is far in the lead. I mean, essentially, the main opposition candidate, as far as he's concerned, is the ex-prime minister who basically has not conceded. I mean, he's not conceded and he doesn't look set to concede because he says more results need to come in. That's Amadou Ba. Now, ultimately, five candidates have already congratulated Faye. And in order for there to be a clear winner in the first round, they need to get more than 50%. And at the moment, we're not sure if Faye has got more than 50%. So that's the thing that we're waiting for at the moment.
And what was it about Faye's campaign that caught the imagination and got the support he needed?
I mean, the main thing is he's the change candidate. I mean, in most elections, obviously, it's going to be a matter of, are you happy with what you've got or do you need change? Now, in Senegal, around 60% of the country is aged under 25. And lots of people in the country are frustrated. Now, what he said was he was going to upend the economy. He said he was going to help to redistribute wealth more widely in the Senegalese economy, because on the face of it, in terms of macroeconomics, Senegal is doing relatively well. But when you dig a little deeper, what you find is that there is high unemployment. Something like 40% of young people are either unemployed or they're not in education or they're not in training. And we see that in the most visceral sense when you look at the number of people who try to flee Senegal and go via the Canary Islands to Europe. So what he was saying was he's going to renegotiate oil and gas contracts and as a result of that, try and redistribute wealth so that more people get access to wealth and there are more jobs so you can tackle unemployment. And that really seems to have struck a chord with the electorate. And as I, when I say the electorate, I mean the vast majority of young people who are backing him.
And do you think we can expect, come the time, a peaceful transition from Macky Sall?
I mean, I really do believe there would be a peaceful transition from Macky Sall. I mean, he did delay, and the reason why this has all come to a head is because he delayed the election and he tried to hold off. Now, the sources that we've spoken to at Semaphore Africa, the suggestion is that he was holding off because he wasn't convinced that his guy, Amadou Ba, who was the candidate for the ruling coalition, would secure enough votes to win. He was concerned, by the sounds of it, that that they were going to lose, and so he tried to hold on. But ultimately, he will hand over peacefully. Senegal has a reputation, a well-earned reputation, for having strong institutions and having always had peaceful handovers of power. So I believe this will continue.
It is, as you say, a beacon of democracy in West Africa. Why do you think, though, there's been sort of the turbulence of the last few years? Is it sort of the same thing, many countries having the experience of the pandemic and the sort of economic strains that you mentioned there, particularly amongst young people?
I think there are a number of reasons. Yes, I think the resulting increase in the cost of living, high inflation off the back of the war in Ukraine has really caused problems. It's caused strains. It means that the cost of living has gone up and at the same time there's been high unemployment. So life is getting harder for Senegalese people and specifically Senegalese young people because they don't see a viable future. And as I say, that's why so many of them try to leave and go to Europe. As well as that, though, a lot of this is actually just internal politics. A lot of this has come down to the efforts of the ruling coalition to find a way to try and stay in power. And Macky Sall, in particular, the outgoing president whose term ends on the 2nd of April, he was trying to hold on. And for some time, it wasn't even clear if he was going to try and push for a third term. He argued that because there'd been a change in presidential election terms while he was in power, he essentially reset the clock. And so if he went for another term, it wouldn't be a third term, it would be a second term. So that has caused the instability. This is completely unlike the instability we've seen in other parts of West Africa. In Western Central Africa, we've seen Islamist insurgents essentially destabilizing countries. And those insurgencies have caused problems and frustrations and lots of people. And when I say lots, I mean thousands of people have been killed and millions have been forced to flee their homes. And that's in other parts of West Africa, places like Burkina Faso, Niger and Mali. What's happened in Senegal is completely unlike that. That's internal politics and the cost of living.
And a factor in all elections at the moment is outside influence. And in Africa, across the continent, particularly influence coming in from the likes of Russia and from China as well. Is that something that we saw play a part at all in this election, in the disinformation sphere at all?
No, this hasn't been an issue in the same way that you see in other parts of the continent, certainly not in other parts of Western Central Africa. Misinformation, disinformation has not been an issue. The bigger outside force that you see in Senegal is actually France, the former colonial power, because they have very strong business ties in the country, and that's continued. But even still, that has not been an issue. The issue of disinformation has been an issue in other parts of West Africa because Russia has offered itself as a viable military partner for countries that are battling insurgencies, and that's why they've grown in popularity. That's not an issue in Senegal.
Alexis Akwajiram, thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Now, as Russia's full-scale invasion rages on, Ukraine is running dangerously low on munitions as US aid hangs in the balance. Earlier, Monocle's Andrew Muller spoke to Ambassador Mark Green, a diplomat and former US congressman who now serves as president and CEO of the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. Andrew began by asking Ambassador Green about his recent trip to war-torn Ukraine and what his key takeaways were.
First off, the extraordinary resilience of the Ukrainian people. They kept saying to us over and over again, tell the West that we are tired but not exhausted. And whenever there's a missile strike, which is a daily occurrence, they move quickly to rebuild, to clean up, to do everything they can to make life as normal as possible. Secondly, I was struck by how people in Ukraine are hanging on every word and every political move in the capitals of Europe and back here in Washington, D.C. One of my traveling companions joked that he swore he heard one talking to another about cloture and filibuster, which is a pretty disgusting thing to get tossed around in any setting, let alone back in Ukraine. But they really are. And so while they're resilient, while they're hanging tough, they're also looking for signals of support. And it's not even just the numbers, right? It's not just the money. It's a broad signal of support from the West. Third, I was struck by how differently they view the conflict than we do, or that many people do back here in Washington. In Washington, the media talks about it like it's some bilateral skirmish in the family between Ukrainians and Putin. And of course, they look at this as being dictatorship on the march. We were also in Moldova. And Moldovans said to us, look, let's make it clear. We're next. We're already seeing the disinformation. We're even seeing fragments of drones inside our borders. There is a real disconnect there. And then finally, I was struck by the nature of Putin's tactics. It really is a hybrid battlefield that he's embraced. He's targeting civilian infrastructure, schools, energy and power facilities, and human displacement. He is purposefully chasing people so they're on the move, internally displaced and into bordering countries in an effort to destabilize those countries. So it is really quite remarkable what he's doing, and yet the Ukrainians themselves are hanging tough.
Is it possible to explain how and why it is that the Republican Party of all institutions has become so sympathetic to Russia at a time when Russia is laying siege to a European democracy?
Well, I think in Ukraine, it's more a general sense of anxiety they feel about the inaction out of Washington. I'm not sure that they themselves necessarily ascribe it to one party or the other. I certainly will. And I'll look at my former institution, the House of Representatives. I was just up on the Hill yesterday, and everyone I met with said, oh, yeah, this will get done. And then you keep saying, well, you're talking about it in the third person. You actually are the ones who have to get this done. I think they will. But if we're not careful, American politics will accomplish that which Vladimir Putin could not, which is to shake the resolve of the Ukrainian people. You know, I'm an old Reagan Republican. Mm-hmm. I used to lead the International Republican Institute. John McCain was my chairman. So I'm a believer in American strength. And somehow people are viewing this as not central to American leadership. I heard a senator, happened to be a Republican senator, put it well. He said, look, deterrence is not divisible. We have to understand that you're either leading and you're deterring or you're not. You can't pick and choose. And so it's disappointing because what seems to be political gamesmanship back here is deadly serious over there.
Well, this is what I'm wondering, and I can only imagine how frustrating this must be to an old school Reagan slash McCain Republican. But if you look at the person leading the Republican caucus in the House of Representatives now, i.e. Speaker Mike Johnson, does he not know how crucial US support is, both in terms of equipment and morale, or does he simply not care?
Well, I've not spoken with him directly, but everything that I've heard, including from Ukrainians, Ukrainian representatives here in Washington, also heard when I was over there, that he has expressed his support to them. And so they do believe this will eventually get done. You know, right now, I think there's a sense of war weariness back here in Washington, especially with what's going on now in Haiti. People look around and see the fighting and it appears open-ended, but that's obviously not an excuse for inaction. And so while people may feel this general sense of anxiety and war weariness, obviously we have to lead. Nobody else will.
A refrain I've certainly heard speaking to Ukrainians, both ordinary Ukrainian people and current and former Ukrainian office holders over the last couple of years, is this frustration that, as they often put it, we're being given enough to survive, but not enough to win. There's a sense that the rest of the world thinks this can somehow be contained as a little local difficulty, and no one wants to deal with the extraordinary difficulties which would be posed by a defeated Russia. And we've seen the current US administration urging Ukraine to wind it in terms of striking directly against Russia's energy infrastructure. What's your view on that? Should there be any constraints placed upon Ukraine in how Ukraine takes the fight to Russia?
I think it is a fair criticism of leaders in both parties and leaders at, as we would put it, both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. They have not done a very good job of presenting a vision for success. What is it that we all want to see? I think the American people, they believe in freedom, they believe in democracy, and they believe in strength, but give them a vision that they can get around. Give them some sense that there's a plan. I think that in the West, both in Europe and in the U.S., we've been a step slow in responding to Ukrainian requests. That has not been helpful. My view is that we should have given what Ukraine asked for in terms of weapon systems and other resources far sooner. I think that would have been more helpful. I think it would have changed the course of recent events in a positive way. And so I do think that there's a problem that we have not done a very good job. We seem to always be in our back foot. We give them what they ask for, but belatedly, almost meekly, as if we'd rather not do it, but we feel we have no choice. And we haven't done a very good job of saying, look, this is what it is that we want to see. And this is why it is in our interest, our being both sides of the Atlantic, to see Ukraine win and to see Ukraine win soon, quickly.
That was Ambassador Mark Green, President and CEO of the Wilson Center, speaking to Andrew Muller. You're with Monocle Radio. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Time to get the latest business news now from Bloomberg's Ewan Potts, who joins us from Dubai. Ewan, big tech on the hook, and this time it's from the European Union.
Vincent, yeah, Brussels has opened a full-blown investigation into several of the big tech firms and their compliance with strict new rules. Apple, Alphabet's Google, and Meta Platforms are all being investigated. Now, Apple and Google's App Store rules are being targeted under the Blocked Digital Markets Act, and how Google search results might unfairly put forward its own services. It's also being targeted. Apple may find it harder for users to choose alternatives to its Safari web browser. So the EU is really cracking down on a number of practices from the world's big, big tech companies, all big American tech companies. Instagram and Facebook owner Meta, well, it is being targeted for its new subscription fees. It plans to introduce these for users who don't want to see adverts. And those are going to be looked into by the European Union as well. Amazon is not getting off the hook either. Its ranking practices on its marketplace are being looked into. Of course, Amazon has lots of products from third-party sellers, and the European Union is concerned that they're not receiving the prominence they should do when competing with Amazon's own in-house delivery. So the firms could face fines of as much as 10% of global revenue. That is really no joke. We're up to 20% in the case of repeated breaches. So potentially these could be enormous fines. All the companies are fighting this. Apple say that it's confident that it complies with the EU's new legislation. And Google says it's made significant changes to its services in Europe, and it will continue to defend its approach in the coming months. So far in pre-market trading in New York, traders are still having a snooze at this moment. In pre-market trading, the company's shares are down a touch, but they don't seem to have reacted particularly strongly to this news yet. But this is clearly a big, big approach from Brussels at the moment.
And lots of people will be looking forward to tucking into some chocolate on Easter Sunday. But it's bad news for those actually buying the Easter eggs.
Yeah, when American confectionery giant Mars recently made a quick, quiet tweak to its popular Galaxy chocolate bar in the UK last year, shaving 10 grams off the standard product size and repackaging it without lowering the price, shoppers were a little bit taken aback. But cocoa traders, well, they weren't surprised at all. Cocoa futures have been on a remarkable tear this year. Cocoa prices are up 50% this month alone, and the price has doubled over the course of this year, but just at the end of March. Poor harvests on the back of bad weather and crop diseases in West African nations. There are a couple of countries in West Africa which produce almost all of the world's cocoa. They've really seen the price rocketing. Easter eggs were already getting more expensive this year due to last year's price jump, and many manufacturers are curbing egg sizes or promoting products with other ingredients in an attempt to soften the blow. Cocoa is an extreme example, but a number of other food crops are also elevated at the moment. Citrus greening, an incurable disease spread by insects, has been ravaging the orange crop, and export controls and water shortages are affecting supplies of rice. Sugar has been hit by dry spells in Asia. And 2 years on, the war in Ukraine is still keeping vegetable oil prices elevated. Of course, Ukraine, a big, big producer of sunflowers for oil. There's also a wider issue with cocoa, and that is tough new rules being introduced by the EU, which are aimed at stopping products that destroy forests from being sold in shops. So cocoa prices really on an incredible tear. It's actually more expensive than copper ton for ton now, which is the first time that's ever happened.
Well, bad news for anyone with a sweet tooth. Easter Bunny even getting hit by shrinkflation there. Ewan Potts, thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Now, in her 50-year career, the British artist Maggie Hambling has made a name for herself with her dynamic, expressionist paintings and oftentimes controversial public sculptures. Now, Hambling has a new solo show at Pearl Lam Galleries in Hong Kong entitled The Night. The exhibition riffs on that period of time, which has been an enduring subject for her, and includes two new series of paintings that have never been seen before. Maggie stopped by Midori House to speak to Monocle's Robert Bound. Robert began by asking her about her interest in Chinese drawings.
I'm a great believer in the Chinese idea that you've got to be as eloquent where you don't make a mark as where you do make a mark. Mm-hmm. It's quite tricky. But even when I filled more of the canvas with paint than I do nowadays, I always left a bit of bare canvas for Samuel Beckett, you know, for Waiting for Godot, yeah. You know, always a bit. But as I got older, I try to say more with less.
Does that take a career's worth of painting and knowing what to know what to leave out, I wonder?
Yes, I think it does. I think it does, to get rid of all the unnecessary bits. Mm. I mean, I get up very early in the morning and I make a drawing in my sketchbook with ink with my left hand to renew the sense of touch on the paper each morning. It's like a pianist doing the scales,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
And I do use my left hand because it's full of surprises and I don't know quite what it'll do because this hand is full of tricks after all these years, do you know? Boring, boring, boring.
So this kind of does what you think it's going to do a little bit more, and the left one is a law unto itself, at least at that time in the morning.
It is.
And this is at your studio in Suffolk. That must be that moment of, don't want to place a silly word in our mouths, but that moment of communion with the paper, with the canvas must be, does that feel fresh every morning?
It feels very fresh every morning. And of course, it is the best time of day because nobody telephones.
Right.
And the world is one's own. And when, I mean, for 4 or 5 years, I'd get up early in the morning and go and draw the sea. Mm. And there was no one else there. It was fantastic.
There are moments of liquidity and kineticism in this body of work, The Night, and obviously, your look at the night sky itself, your works that address the night precisely, or pretty precisely, and I understand that's something that you did, some of your first works when you were a teenager, or certainly at art school, were concerned with the night, fascinated with the night.
It's even earlier than that. When I was 13 at school, and I was drawing, and the art teacher came round and said, "Why are you drawing?" Because all the other girls were painting. I don't know what I said. Anyway, she sort of suggested that I might be colourblind, which I thought was a bit of a cheek. So I did a painting just to show her I wasn't colourblind. And then there was an art exam when I was 14, and I did nothing but flick paint at people and generally draw attention to myself because I was deeply in love with a biology mistress who was invigilating the exam. And then I saw the clock in a bit of terror. It was 3:20, and at 3:30 I knew I had to hand in a painting, so I did one without thinking. Mm-hmm. And then when the results came out 2 or 3 weeks later, I was top of art. So I thought, my God, this is quite interesting. I must look into this business, you know. It seems I'm good at it, and I don't even try or something. And so then I stayed up until 2 o'clock in the morning, trying to paint the night sky out of my bedroom window. And I took them into school the next day, and they were all laid out on these tables. And the art teacher came into the room, and I was sort of standing in the corner and on the point of tears. And she said, came up to me and said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "Well, I was up until 2 o'clock in the morning trying to paint the night sky out of my bedroom window, and everyone's laughing at them." And so she said to me, "It just must be water off a duck's back. Don't take a blind bit of notice of whatever anyone says about your work. You're your own best critic. And just must be water off a duck's back." So I was very lucky to have that said to me at the age of 14.
So that's been like the words through the Hambling stick of rock, something
yes,
like that, the family motto. And the night is, obviously, it's a place of madness, it's a place of romance, it's a place of carnal desire as well. These seem to be addressed in these new works that are going on display in Hong Kong. To you, is it all those things? Was it all those things from those first, you said you had a crush on the, or you were in love with the biology mistress. Is there a through line to this collection from those days?
I mean, for that exam, I mean, there were three subjects and I chose the subject of laziness. And I painted a woman lying on a chaise longue with a half-open book. In other words, she was too lazy even to read the book. So it was the night sky came after that. But, I mean, it's a sort of universal place. I mean, whether we're in China or whether we're in London, I mean, there is the night sky. It's a mysterious, I mean, mysterious sort of realm where dream meets reality and where sex meets mythology and the unknown meets the known. And it's a strange place.
That was the artist Maggie Hambling in conversation with Monocle's Robert Bound. The night at Pearl Lam Galleries in Hong Kong opens tomorrow and runs until the 16th of May. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. Do subscribe to the programme wherever you get your podcasts, and do leave us a review and rating too. If you want to get in touch, my email is vm@monocle.com. This programme was produced by Emma Searle, our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio managers were Lily Austin and Mariella Bevan. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.